Chapter 9. The road was crowded, and there were screens of corn stalk and straw matting on both sides, and matting over the top so that it was like the entrance at a circus or a native village. We drove slowly in this matting-covered tunnel and came out onto a bare cleared space where the railway station had been. The road here was below the level of the river bank, and all along the side of the sunken road there were holes dug in the bank with infantry in them. The sun was going down, and looking up along the bank as we drove, I saw the Austrian observation balloons above the hills on the other side, dark against the sunset. We parked the cars beyond a brickyard. The ovens and some deep holes had been equipped as dressing stations. There were three doctors that I knew. I talked with the major and learned that when it should start and our car should be loaded, we would drive them back along the screened road and up to the main road along the ridge, where there would be a post and other cars to clear them. He hoped the road would not jam. It was a one-road show. The road was screened because it was in sight of the Austrians across the river. Here at the brickyard, we were sheltered from rifle or machine-gun fire by the river bank. There was one smashed bridge across the river. They were going to put over another bridge when the bombardment started, and some troops were to cross at the shallows up above at the bend of the river. The major was a little man with upturned mustaches. He had been in the war in Libya and wore two wound stripes. He said that if the thing went well, he would see that I was decorated. I said I hoped it would go well, but that he was too kind. I asked him if there was a big dugout where the drivers could stay, and he sent a soldier to show me. I went with him and found the dugout, which was very good. The drivers were pleased with it, and I left them there. The major asked me to have a drink with him and two other officers. We drank rum, and it was very friendly. Outside it was getting dark. I asked what time the attack was to be, and they said as soon as it was dark. I went back to the drivers. They were sitting in the dugout talking, and when I came in, they stopped. I gave them each a package of cigarettes, Macedonias, loosely packed cigarettes that spilled tobacco and needed to have the ends twisted before you smoked them. Manera lit his lighter and passed it around. The lighter was shaped like a Fiat radiator. I told them what I had heard.
This book is continued on Disc 2. Disc 2.
The lighter was shaped like a Fiat radiator. I told them what I had heard. Why didn't we see the post when we came down? Bassini asked. It was just beyond where we turned off. That road will be a dirty mess, Manera said. They'll shell the shit out of us. Probably. What about eating, Lieutenant? We won't get a chance to eat after this thing starts. I'll go and see now, I said. You want us to stay here, or can we look around? Better stay here. I went back to the major's dugout, and he said the field kitchen would be along, and the drivers could come and get their stew. He would loan the mess tins if they did not have them. I said I thought they had them. I went back and told the drivers I would get them as soon as the food came. Manera said he hoped it would come before the bombardment started. They were silent until I went out. They were all mechanics and hated the war. I went out to look at the cars and see what was going on, and then came back and sat down in the dugout with the four drivers. We sat on the ground with our backs against the wall and smoked. Outside it was nearly dark. The earth of the dugout was warm and dry, and I let my shoulders back against the wall, sitting on the small of my back, and relaxed. "Who goes to the attack?" said Gavuzzi.
"Bersaglieri."
"All Bersaglieri?"
"I think so.
There aren't enough troops here for a real attack."
"It is probably to draw attention from where the real attack will be."
"Do the men know that, who attack?"
"I don't think so."
"Of course they don't," Manera said. "They wouldn't attack if they did."
"Yes, they would," Passini said. "Bersaglieri are fools."
"They are brave and have good discipline," I said.
"They are big through the chest by measurement and healthy, but they are still fools."
"The Granatieri are tall," Maneri said. This was a joke. They all laughed.
"Were you there, Tenente, when they wouldn't attack and they shot every 10th man?"
"No."
"It is true. They lined them up afterward and took every 10th man. Carabinieri shot them."
"Carabinieri," said Passini and spat on the floor. "But those grenadiers, all over 6 feet, they wouldn't attack."
If everybody would not attack, the war would be over, Manera said. It wasn't that way with the Granatieri. They were afraid. The officers all came from such good families. Some of the officers went alone. A sergeant shot two officers who would not get out. Some troops went out. Those that went out were not lined up when they took the 10th man. One of those shot by the Carabinieri is from my town, Pacini said. He was a big, smart, tall boy to be in the Granatieri. Always in Rome, always with the girls, always with the Carabinieri. He laughed. Now they have a guard outside his house with a bayonet, and nobody can come to see his mother and father and sisters, and his father loses his civil rights and cannot even vote. They are all without law to protect them. Anybody can take their property. If it wasn't that that happens to their families, nobody would go to the attack. Yes, Alpini would. Those VE soldiers would. Some Bersaglieri. Bersaglieri have run too. Now they try to forget it. You should not let us talk this way, Tenente. E viva l'esercito, Pacini said sarcastically. I know how you talk, I said, but as long as you drive the cars and behave. And don't talk so other officers can hear, Manera finished. I believe we should get the war over, I said. It would not finish it if one side stopped fighting. It would only be worse if we stopped fighting. It could not be worse, Pacini said respectfully. There is nothing worse than war. Defeat is worse. I do not believe it, Pacini said, still respectfully. What is defeat? You go home. They come after you. They take your home. They take your sisters. I don't believe it, Pacini said. They can't do that to everybody. Let everybody defend his home. Let him keep their sisters in the house. They hang you. They come and make you be a soldier again. Not in the auto ambulance, in the infantry. They can't hang everyone. An outside nation can't make you be a soldier, Manera said. At the first battle, you all run. Like the Czechos. I think you do not know anything about being conquered, and so you think it is not bad. Tenente, Pacini said. We understand you let us talk. Listen, there is nothing as bad as war. We in the auto ambulance cannot even realize at all how bad it is. When people realize how bad it is, they cannot do anything to stop it because they go crazy. There are some people who never realize. There are people who are afraid of their officers. It is with them the war is made. I know it is bad, but we must finish it. It doesn't finish. There is no finish to a war. Yes, there is. Pacini shook his head. War is not won by victory. What if we take San Gabriele? What if we take the Carso and Monfalcone and Trieste? Where are we then? Did you see all the far mountains today? Do you think we could take all them, too? Only if the Austrians stop fighting. One side must stop fighting. Why don't we stop fighting? If they come down into Italy, they will get tired and go away. They have their own country. But no, instead there is a war. You're an orator. We think, we read, we are not peasants, we are mechanics. But even the peasants know better than to believe in a war. Everybody hates this war. There is a class that controls a country that is stupid and does not realize anything and never can. That is why we have this war. Also, they make money out of it. Most of them don't, said Pacini. They're too stupid. They do it for nothing, for stupidity. We must shut up, said Manera. We talk too much even for the Tenente. He likes it, said Pacini. We will convert him. But now we will shut up, Manera said. Do we eat yet, Tenente? Gavuzzi asked. I will go and see, I said. Gordini stood up and went outside with me. Is there anything I can do, Tenente? Can I help in any way? He was the quietest one of the four. Come with me if you want, I said, and we'll see. It was dark outside, and the long light from the searchlights was moving over the mountains. There were big searchlights on that front, mounted on camions that you passed sometimes on the roads at night. Close behind the lines, the camion stopped a little off the road, an officer directing the light and the crew scared. We crossed the brickyard and stopped at the main dressing station. There was a little shelter of green branches outside over the entrance, and in the dark, the night wind rustled the leaves dried by the sun. Inside, there was a light. The major was at the telephone sitting on a box. One of the medical captains said the attack had been put forward an hour. He offered me a glass of cognac.
I looked at the board tables, the instruments shining in the light, the basins and the stoppered bottles. Gordini stood behind me. The major got up from the telephone. "It starts now," he said. "It has been put back again." I looked outside. It was dark, and the Austrian searchlights were moving on the mountains behind us. It was quiet for a moment still. Then, from all the guns behind us, the bombardment started.
"Savoia," said the major.
"About the soup, Major," I said. He did not hear me. I repeated it. "It hasn't come up." A big shell came in and burst outside in the brickyard. Another burst, and in the noise you could hear the smaller noise of the brick and dirt raining down.
"What is there to eat?"
"We have a little pasta asciutta," the major said.
"I'll take what you can give me."
The major spoke to an orderly who went out of sight in the back and came back with a metal basin of cold cooked macaroni. I handed it to Gordini.
"Have you any cheese?"
The major spoke grudgingly to the orderly who ducked back into the hole again and came out with a quarter of a white cheese.
"Thank you very much," I said.
"You'd better not go out." Outside, something was set down beside the entrance. One of the two men who had carried it looked in.
"Bring him in," said the major. "What's the matter with you? Do you want us to come outside and get him?"
The two stretcher-bearers picked up the man under the arms and by the legs and brought him in.
"Slit the tunic," the major said.
He held a forceps with some gauze in the end. The two captains took off their coats.
"Get out of here," the major said to the two stretcher-bearers.
"Come on," I said to Gordini.
"You better wait until the shelling is over," the major said over his shoulder.
"They want to eat," I said.
"As you wish."
Outside, we ran across the brickyard. A shell burst short near the river bank. Then there was one that we did not hear coming until the sudden rush. We both went flat, and with the flash and bump of the burst and the smell, heard the singing off of the fragments and the rattle of falling brick. Gordini got up and ran for the dugout. I was after him, holding the cheese, its smooth surface covered with brick dust. Inside the dugout were the three drivers sitting against the wall, smoking.
"Here, you patriots," I said.
"How are the cars?" Manera asked.
"All right."
"Did they scare you, Tenente?"
"You're damned right," I said.
I took out my knife, opened it, wiped off the blade, and pared off the dirty outside surface of the cheese. Gavuzzi handed me the basin of macaroni.
"Start in to eat, Tenente."
"No," I said. "Put it on the floor. We'll all eat."
"There are no forks."
"What the hell?" I said in English. I cut the cheese into pieces and laid them on the macaroni.
"Sit down to it," I said.
They sat down and waited. I put thumb and fingers into the macaroni and lifted. The mass loosened.
"Lift it high, Tenente."
I lifted it to arm's length and the strands cleared. I lowered it into the mouth, sucked and snapped in the ends, and chewed, then took a bite of cheese, chewed, and then a drink of the wine. It tasted of rusty metal. I handed the canteen back to Passini.
"It's rotten," he said. "It's been in there too long. I had it in the car."
They were all eating, holding their chins close over the basin, tipping their heads back, sucking in the ends. I took another mouthful and some cheese and a rinse of wine. Something landed outside that shook the earth.
420 or Minnenwerfer," Gavuzzi said.
"There aren't any 420s in the mountains," I said.
"They have big Skoda guns. I've seen the holes."
305s. We went on eating. There was a cough, a noise like a railway engine starting, and then an explosion that shook the earth again.
"This isn't a deep dugout," Passini said.
"That was a big trench mortar."
"Yes, sir."
I ate the end of my piece of cheese and took a swallow of wine. Through the other noise I heard a cough, then came the ch-ch-ch-ch. Then there was a flash, as when a blast furnace door is swung open, and a roar that started white and went red and on in a rushing wind. I tried to breathe, but my breath would not come, and I felt myself rush bodily out of myself, and out, and out, and out, and all the time bodily in the wind.
I went out swiftly, all of myself, and I knew I was dead and that it had all been a mistake to think you just died. Then I floated, and instead of going on, I felt myself slide back. I breathed, and I was back. The ground was torn up, and in front of my head there was a splintered beam of wood. In the jolt of my head, I heard somebody crying. I thought somebody was screaming. I tried to move, but I could not move. I heard the machine guns and rifles firing across the river and all along the river. There was a great splashing, and I saw the star shells go up and burst and float whitely, and rockets going up, and heard the bombs, all this in a moment. And then I heard close to me someone saying, "Mamma mia! Oh, mamma mia!" I pulled and twisted and got my legs loose, finally, and turned around and touched him. It was Passini, and when I touched him, he screamed. His legs were toward me, and I saw in the dark and the light that they were both smashed above the knee. One leg was gone, and the other was held by tendons and part of the trouser, and the stump twitched and jerked as though it were not connected. He bit his arm and moaned, "Oh, mamma mia, mamma mia!" Then, "Dio te salve Maria, Dio te salve Maria, oh Jesus, shoot me, Christ, shoot me, mamma mia, oh purest lovely Mary, shoot me, stop it, stop it, stop it, oh Jesus, lovely Mary, stop it, oh, 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 oh," then choking, "Mamma, mamma mia." Then he was quiet, biting his arm, the stump of his leg twitching. "Porta ferita," I shouted, holding my hands cupped. "Porta ferita!" I tried to get closer to Passini to try to put a tourniquet on the legs, but I could not move. I tried again, and my legs moved a little. I could pull backward along with my arms and elbows. Passini was quiet now. I sat beside him, undid my tunic, and tried to rip the tail of my shirt. It would not rip, and I bit the edge of the cloth to start it. Then I thought of his puttees. I had on wool stockings, but Passini wore puttees. All the drivers wore puttees, but Passini had only one leg. I unwound the puttee, and while I was doing it, I saw there was no need to try and make a tourniquet because he was dead already. I made sure he was dead. There were three others to locate. I sat up straight, and as I did so, something inside my head moved like the weights on a doll's eyes, and it hit me inside and back of my eyeballs. My legs felt warm and wet, and my shoes were wet and warm inside. I knew that I was hit, and leaned over and put my hand on my knee. My knee wasn't there. My hand went in, and my knee was down on my shin. I wiped my hand on my shirt, and another floating light came very slowly down, and I looked at my leg and was very afraid. "Oh, God," I said, "get me out of here." I knew, however, that there had been three others. There were four drivers. Passini was dead. That left three. Someone took hold of me under the arms, and somebody else lifted my legs. "There are three others," I said. "One is dead." "It's Manera. We went for a stretcher, but there wasn't any. How are you, Tenente?" "Where's Gordini and Gavuzzi?" "Gordini's at the post getting bandaged. Gavuzzi has your legs. Hold on to my neck, Tenente. Are you badly hit?" "In the leg. How is Gordini?" "He's all right. It was a big trench mortar shell." "Passini's dead." "Yes, he's dead." A shell fell close, and they both dropped to the ground and dropped me. "I'm sorry, Tenente," said Manera. "Hang on to my neck."
"If you drop me again..."
"It was because we were scared."
"Are you unwounded?"
"We were both wounded a little."
"Can Gordini drive?"
"I don't think so."
They dropped me once more before we reached the post.
"You sons of bitches," I said.
"I'm sorry, Tenente," Manera said. "We won't drop you again."
Outside the post, a great many of us lay on the ground in the dark. They carried wounded in and brought them out. I could see the light come out from the dressing station when the curtain opened and they brought someone in or out. The dead were off to one side. The doctors were working with their sleeves up to their shoulders and were red as butchers. There were not enough stretchers. Some of the wounded were noisy, but most were quiet. The wind blew the leaves in the bower over the door of the dressing station, and the night was getting cold. Stretcher-bearers came in all the time, put their stretchers down, unloaded them, and went away. As soon as I got to the dressing station, Manera brought a medical sergeant out, and he put bandages on both my legs. He said there was so much dirt blown into the wound that there had not been much hemorrhage. They would take me as soon as possible. He went back inside. Gordini could not drive, Manera said. His shoulder was smashed and his head was hurt. He had not felt bad, but now the shoulder had stiffened. He was sitting up beside one of the brick walls. Manera and Gavuzzi each went off with a load of wounded. They could drive all night. The British had come with three ambulances, and they had two men on each ambulance. One of their drivers came over to me, brought by Gordini, who looked very white and sick. The Britisher leaned over. "Are you hit badly?" he asked. He was a tall man and wore steel-rimmed spectacles. "In the legs. It's not serious, I hope. Will you have a cigarette?" "Thanks. They tell me you've lost two drivers." "Yes, one killed and the fellow that brought you."
"What rotten luck. Would you like us to take the cars?"
"That's what I wanted to ask you."
"We'd take quite good care of them and return them to the villa. 206, aren't you?"
"Yes."
"It's a charming place. I've seen you about. They tell me you're an American."
"Yes."
"I'm English."
"No."
"Yes, English. Did you think I was Italian? There were some Italians with one of our units."
"It would be fine if you would take the cars," I said.
"We'll be most careful of them."
He straightened up.
"This chap of yours was very anxious for me to see you."
He patted Gordini on the shoulder. Gordini winced and smiled. The Englishman broke into voluble and perfect Italian.
"Now everything is arranged. I've seen your tenente. We will take over the two cars. You won't worry now."
He broke off.
"I must do something about getting you out of here. I'll see the medical wallahs. We'll take you back with us."
He walked across to the dressing station, stepping carefully among the wounded. I saw the blanket open, the light came out, and he went in.
"He will look after you, tenente," Gordini said.
"How are you, Franco?"
"I'm all right."
He sat down beside me. In a moment, the blanket in front of the dressing station opened, and two stretcher-bearers came out, followed by the tall Englishman. He brought them over to me.
"Here is the American tenente," he said in Italian.
"I'd rather wait," I said. "They're much worse wounded than me. I'm all right."
"Come, come," he said. "Don't be a bloody hero."
Then in Italian, "Lift him very carefully about the legs. His legs are very painful. He is the legitimate son of President Wilson." They picked me up and took me into the dressing room. Inside, they were operating on all the tables. The little major looked at us furious. He recognized me and waved a forceps.
"Ça va bien?"
"Ça va."
"I have brought him in," the tall Englishman said in Italian. "The only son of the American ambassador. He can be here until you are ready to take him. Then I will take him with my first load."
He bent over me. "I'll look up their adjutant to do your papers, and it will all go much faster." He stooped to go under the doorway and went out. The major was unhooking the forceps now, dropping them in a basin. I followed his hands with my eyes. Now he was bandaging. Then the stretcher-bearers took the man off the table.
"I'll take the American tenente," one of the captains said.
They lifted me onto the table. It was hard and slippery. There were many strong smells, chemical smells and the sweet smell of blood. They took off my trousers, and the medical captain commenced dictating to the sergeant adjutant while he worked. "Multiple superficial wounds of the left and right thigh and left and right knee and right foot. Profound wounds of right knee and foot. Lacerations of the scalp." He probed. "Does that hurt?"
"Christ, yes."
"With possible fracture of the skull, incurred in the line of duty. That's what keeps you from being court-martialed for self-inflicted wounds," he said. "Would you like a drink of brandy? How did you run into this thing, anyway? What were you trying to do, commit suicide?" "Anti-tetanus, please, and mark a cross on both legs." "Thank you. Now clean this up a little, wash it out, and put on a dressing. Your blood coagulates beautifully." The adjutant, looking up from the paper, "What inflicted the wounds?" The medical captain, "What hit you?" Me, with the eyes shut, "A trench mortar shell." The captain, doing things that hurt sharply and severing tissue, "Are you sure?" Me, trying to lie still and feeling my stomach flutter when the flesh was cut, "I think so." Captain Doctor, interested in something he was finding, "Fragments of enemy trench mortar shell. Now, I'll probe for some of this if you like, but that's not necessary. I'll paint all this and—" "Does that sting?" "Good. That's nothing to how it will feel later.
The pain hasn't started yet. Bring him a glass of brandy. The shock dulls the pain, but this is all right. You have nothing to worry about if it doesn't infect, and it rarely does now. How is your head?
Good Christ, I said. Oh, better not drink too much brandy, then. If you've got a fracture, you don't want inflammation. How does that feel?
Sweat ran all over me.
Good Christ, I said.
I guess you've got a fracture, all right. I'll wrap you up and don't bounce your head around.
He bandaged, his hands moving very fast and the bandage coming taut and sure.
All right, good luck and vive la France.
He's an American, one of the other captains said.
I thought you said he was a Frenchman. He talks French, the captain said. I've known him before. I always thought he was French.
He drank a half tumbler of cognac.
Bring on something serious. Get some more of that anti-tetanus.
The captain waved to me. They lifted me, and the blanket flap went across my face as we went out. Outside, the sergeant adjutant knelt down beside me where I lay.
Name? He asked softly. Middle name? First name? Rank? Where born? What class? What corps? And so on.
I'm sorry for your head, Tenente. I hope you feel better. I'm sending you now with the English ambulance.
I'm all right, I said. Thank you very much.
The pain that the major had spoken about had started, and all that was happening was without interest or relation. After a while, the English ambulance came up, and they put me onto a stretcher and lifted the stretcher up to the ambulance level and shoved it in. There was another stretcher by the side with a man on it whose nose I could see, waxy-looking, out of the bandages. He breathed very heavily. There were stretchers lifted and slid into the slings above. The tall English driver came around and looked in.
"I'll take it very easily," he said. "I hope you'll be comfy."
I felt the engine start, felt him climb up into the front seat, felt the brake come off and the clutch go in. Then we started. I lay still and let the pain ride. As the ambulance climbed along the road, it was slow in the traffic. Sometimes it stopped, sometimes it backed on a turn. Then finally it climbed quite fast. I felt something dripping. At first it dropped slowly and regularly, then it pattered into a stream. I shouted to the driver. He stopped the car and looked in through the hole behind his seat.
"What is it?"
"The man on the stretcher over me has a hemorrhage."
"We're not far from the top. I won't be able to get the stretcher out alone."
He started the car. The stream kept on. In the dark, I could not see where it came from the canvas overhead. I tried to move sideways so that it did not fall on me. Where it had run down under my shirt, it was warm and sticky. I was cold, and my leg hurt so that it made me sick. After a while, the stream from the stretcher above lessened and started to drip again, and I heard and felt the canvas above move as the man on the stretcher settled more comfortably.
"How is he?" the Englishman called back.
"We're almost up."
"He's dead, I think," I said.
The drops fell very slowly, as they fall from an icicle after the sun has gone. It was cold in the car in the night as the road climbed. At the post on the top, they took the stretcher out and put another in, and we went on.
Chapter 10. In the ward at the field hospital, they told me a visitor was coming to see me in the afternoon. It was a hot day, and there were many flies in the room. My orderly had cut paper into strips and tied the strips to a stick to make a brush that swished the flies away. I watched them settle on the ceiling. When he stopped swishing and fell asleep, they came down, and I blew them away, and finally covered my face with my hands and slept too. It was very hot, and when I woke, my legs itched. I waked the orderly, and he poured mineral water on the dressings. That made the bed damp and cool. Those of us that were awake talked across the ward. The afternoon was a quiet time. In the morning they came to each bed in turn, three men nurses and a doctor, and picked you up out of bed and carried you into the dressing room so that the beds could be made while we were having our wounds dressed. It was not a pleasant trip to the dressing room, and I did not know until later that beds could be made with men in them. My orderly had finished pouring water, and the bed felt cool and lovely, and I was telling him where to scratch on the soles of my feet against the itching, when one of the doctors brought in Rinaldi. He came in very fast and bent down over the bed and kissed me. I saw he wore gloves.
How are you, baby? How do you feel? I bring you this.
It was a bottle of cognac. The orderly brought a chair, and he sat down.
And good news. You will be decorated. They want to get you the Medaglia d'Argento, but perhaps they can get only the bronze.
What for?
Because you are gravely wounded. They say if you can prove you did any heroic act, you can get the silver. Otherwise, it will be the bronze. Tell me exactly what happened. Did you do any heroic act?
No, I said. I was blown up while we were eating cheese.
Be serious. You must have done something heroic, either before or after. Remember carefully.
I did not.
Didn't you carry anybody on your back? Gordini says you carried several people on your back, but the medical major at the first post declares it is impossible. He had to sign the proposition for the citation.
I didn't carry anybody. I couldn't move.
That doesn't matter, said Rinaldi.
He took off his gloves.
I think we can get you the silver. Didn't you refuse to be medically aided before the others?
Not very firmly.
That doesn't matter. Look how you are wounded. Look at your valorous conduct in asking to go always to the first line. Besides, the operation was successful.
Did they cross the river all right?
Enormously. They take nearly 1,000 prisoners. It's in the bulletin. Didn't you see it?
No.
I'll bring it to you. It is a successful coup de main.
How is everything?
Splendid. We are all splendid. Everybody is proud of you. Tell me just exactly how it happened. I am positive you will get the silver. Go on, tell me. Tell me all about it.
He paused and thought.
Maybe you will get an English medal, too. There was an English there. I'll go and see him and ask if he will recommend you. He ought to be able to do something. Do you suffer much? Have a drink. Orderly, go get a corkscrew. Oh, you should see what I did in the removal of 3 meters of small intestine, and better now than ever. It is one for the Lancet. You do me a translation, and I will send it to the Lancet. Every day I am better.
Poor dear baby, how do you feel?
Where is that damn corkscrew?
You are so brave and quiet, I forget you are suffering.
He slapped his gloves on the edge of the bed.
Here is the corkscrew, Signor Tenente, the orderly said.
Open the bottle. Bring a glass.
Drink that, baby. How's your poor head?
I looked at your papers. You haven't any fracture. The major at the first post was a hog butcher. I would take you and never hurt you. I never hurt anybody. I learn how to do it. Every day I learn to do things smoother and better. Oh, you must forgive me for talking so much, baby. I am very moved to see you badly wounded. There, drink that. It's good. It cost 15 lire. It ought to be good. 5 stars. After I leave here, I'll go see that English, and he'll get you an English medal.
They don't give them like that.
You are so modest. I will send the liaison officer. He can handle the English.
Have you seen Miss Barclay?
I will bring her here. I will go now and bring her here.
Don't go, I said. Tell me about Gorizia. How are the girls?
There are no girls. For 2 weeks now they haven't changed them. I don't go there anymore. It's disgraceful. They aren't girls. They're old war comrades.
You don't go at all?
I just go to see if there's anything new. I stop by. They all ask for you. It is a disgrace that they should stay so long that they become friends.
Maybe girls don't want to go to the front anymore.
Of course they do. They have plenty of girls. It's just bad administration. They're keeping them for the pleasure of dugout hiders in the rear.
Poor Rinaldi, I said, all alone at the war with no new girls.
Rinaldi poured himself another glass of the cognac. I don't think it will hurt you, baby. You take it.
I drank the cognac and felt it warm all the way down. Rinaldi poured another glass. He was quieter now. He held up the glass.
To your valorous wounds, to the silver medal. Tell me, baby, when you lie here all the time in the hot weather, don't you get excited?
Sometimes.
I can't imagine lying like that. I would go crazy.
You are crazy.
I wish you were back. No one to come in at night from adventures. No one to make fun of. No one to lend me money. No blood brother and roommate. Why did you get yourself wounded?
You can make fun of the priest.
That priest, it isn't me that makes fun of him. It's the captain. I like him. If you must have a priest, have that priest. He's coming to see you. He makes big preparations.
I like him.
Oh, I knew it. Sometimes I think you and he are a little that way, you know?
No, you don't.
Yes, I do sometimes. A little that way, like the number of the 1st Regiment of the Brigata Ancona.
Oh, go to hell.
He stood up and put on his gloves. Oh, I love to tease you, baby, with your priest and your English girl, and really you are just like me underneath.
No, I'm not.
Yes, we are. You are really an Italian, all fire and smoke and nothing inside. You only pretend to be American. We are brothers and we love each other.
Be good while I'm gone, I said.
I will send Miss Barclay. You are better with her without me. You are purer and sweeter.
Oh, go to hell.
I will send her your lovely, cool goddess, English goddess. My God, what would a man do with a woman like that except worship her? What else is an Englishwoman good for?
You are an ignorant, foul-mouthed dago.
A what?
An ignorant wop.
Wop? You are a frozen-faced wop.
You are ignorant, stupid.
I saw that word pricked him and kept on.
Uninformed, inexperienced, stupid from inexperience.
Truly. I tell you something about your good women, your goddesses. There is only one difference between taking a girl who has always been good and a woman. With a girl it is painful. That's all I know.
He slapped the bed with his glove.
And you never know if the girl will really like it.
Don't get angry.
I'm not angry. I just tell you, baby, for your own good, to save you the trouble.
That's the only difference?
Yes, but millions of fools like you don't know it.
You were sweet to tell me.
We won't quarrel, baby. I love you too much, but don't be a fool.
No, I'll be wise like you.
Don't be angry, baby. Laugh. Take a drink. I must go, really.
You're a good old boy.
Now you see. Underneath we are the same. We are war brothers. Kiss me goodbye.
You're sloppy.
No, I'm just more affectionate.
I felt his breath come toward me.
Goodbye, I come to see you again soon.
His breath went away.
I won't kiss you if you don't want. I'll send your English girl. Goodbye, baby. The cognac is under the bed. Get well soon.
He was gone.
Chapter 11. It was dusk when the priest came. They had brought the soup and afterward taken away the bowls, and I was lying looking at the rows of beds and out the window at the treetop that moved a little in the evening breeze. The breeze came in through the window, and it was cooler with the evening. The flies were on the ceiling now and on the electric light bulbs that hung on wires. The lights were only turned on when someone was brought in at night or when something was being done. It made me feel very young to have the dark come after the dusk and then remain. It was like being put to bed after early supper. The orderly came down between the beds and stopped. Someone was with him. It was the priest. He stood there, small, brown-faced, and embarrassed. "How do you do?" he asked. He put some packages down by the bed on the floor. "All right, Father." He sat down in the chair that had been brought for Rinaldi and looked out of the window embarrassedly. I noticed his face looked very tired. "I can only stay a minute," he said. "It is late."
"It's not late. How is the mess?"
He smiled. "I am still a great joke." He sounded tired, too.
"Thank God they are all well."
"I'm so glad you are all right," he said. "I hope you don't suffer." He seemed very tired, and I was not used to seeing him tired.
"Not anymore."
"I miss you at the mess."
"I wish I were there. I always enjoyed our talking."
"I brought you a few little things," he said. He picked up the packages. "This is mosquito netting. This is a bottle of vermouth. You like vermouth? These are English papers.
Please open them."
He was pleased and undid them. I held the mosquito netting in my hands. The vermouth he held up for me to see and then put it on the floor beside the bed. I held up one of the sheaf of English papers. I could read the headlines by turning it so the half-light from the window was on it. It was the news of the world.
"The others are illustrated," he said.
"It will be a great happiness to read them.
Where did you get them?"
"I sent for them to Mestre.
I will have more."
"You are very good to come, Father. Will you drink a glass of vermouth?"
"Thank you. You keep it. It's for you."
"No, drink a glass."
All right. I will bring you more, then.
The orderly brought the glasses and opened the bottle. He broke off the cork, and the end had to be shoved down into the bottle. I could see the priest was disappointed, but he said, "That's all right. It's no matter."
"Here's to your health, Father."
"To your better health."
Afterward, he held the glass in his hand, and we looked at one another. Sometimes we talked and were good friends, but tonight it was difficult.
"What's the matter, Father? You seem very tired."
"I am tired, but I have no right to be."
"It's the heat."
"No, this is only the spring. I feel very low."
"You have the war disgust."
"No, but I hate the war."
"I don't enjoy it," I said.
He shook his head and looked out of the window.
"You do not mind it. You do not see it. You must forgive me. I know you are wounded."
"That is an accident."
"Still, even wounded, you do not see it. I can tell. I do not see it myself, but I feel it a little."
"When I was wounded, we were talking about it. Pacini was talking."
The priest put down the glass. He was thinking about something else.
"I know them because I am like they are," he said.
"You are different, though."
"But really, I am like they are."
"The officers don't see anything."
"Some of them do. Some are very delicate and feel worse than any of us."
"They are mostly different."
"It is not education or money. It is something else. Even if they had education or money, men like Pacini would not wish to be officers. I would not be an officer."
"You rank as an officer. I am an officer."
"I am not really. You are not even an Italian. You are a foreigner. But you are nearer the officers than you are to the men."
"What is the difference?"
"I cannot say it easily. There are people who would make war. In this country there are many like that. There are other people who would not make war."
"But the first ones make them do it."
"Yes."
"And I help them."
"You are a foreigner. You are a patriot."
"And the ones who would not make war, can they stop it?"
"I do not know."
He looked out of the window again. I watched his face.
"Have they ever been able to stop it?" "They are not organized to stop things, and when they get organized, their leaders sell them out."
"Then it's hopeless?"
"It is never hopeless, but sometimes I cannot hope. I try always to hope, but sometimes I cannot."
"Maybe the war will be over."
"I hope so."
"What will you do then?"
"If it is possible, I will return to the Abruzzi."
His brown face was suddenly very happy. "You love the Abruzzi?"
"Oh, yes, I love it very much."
"You ought to go there, then."
"I would be happy to, if I could live there and love God and serve Him."
"And be respected," I said.
"Yes, and be respected. Why not?"
"No reason not. You should be respected."
"It does not matter. But there in my country it is understood that a man may love God. It is not a dirty joke."
"I understand." He looked at me and smiled.
"You understand, but you do not love God."
"No."
"You do not love Him at all?" he asked.
"I am afraid of Him in the night sometimes."
"You should love Him."
"I don't love much."
"Yes," he said, "you do. What you tell me about in the nights, that is not love. That is only passion and lust. When you love, you wish to do things for. You wish to sacrifice for. You wish to serve."
"I don't love."
"You will. I know you will. Then you will be happy."
"I'm happy. I've always been happy."
"It is another thing. You cannot know about it unless you have it."
"Well," I said, "if I ever get it, I will tell you."
"I stay too long and talk too much."
He was worried that he really did.
"No, don't go."
"How about loving women? If I really loved some woman, would it be like that?"
"I don't know about that. I never loved any woman."
"What about your mother?"
"Yes, I must have loved my mother."
"Did you always love God?"
"Ever since I was a little boy."
"Well," I said. I did not know what to say. "You are a fine boy," I said.
I am a boy, he said, but you call me father.
That's politeness.
He smiled.
I must go, really, he said.
You do not want me for anything? He asked hopefully.
No, just to talk.
I will take your greetings to the mess.
Thank you for the many fine presents.
Nothing.
Come and see me again.
Yes, goodbye.
He patted my hand.
So long, I said in dialect.
Ciao, he repeated.
It was dark in the room, and the orderly, who had sat by the foot of the bed, got up and went out with him. I liked him very much, and I hoped he would get back to the Abruzzi sometime. He had a rotten life in the mess, and he was fine about it, but I thought how he would be in his own country. At Capracotta, he had told me, there were trout in the stream below the town. It was forbidden to play the flute at night. When the young men serenaded, only the flute was forbidden. Why, I had asked.
Because it was bad for the girls to hear the flute at night.
The peasants all called you Don, and when you met them they took off their hats. His father hunted every day and stopped to eat at the houses of peasants. They were always honored. For a foreigner to hunt, he must present a certificate that he had never been arrested. There were bears in the Gran Sasso d'Italia, but it was a long way. Aquila was a fine town. It was cool in the summer at night, and the spring in Abruzzi was the most beautiful in Italy. But what was lovely was the fall, to go hunting through the chestnut woods. The birds were all good because they fed on grapes, and you never took a lunch because the peasants were always honored if you would eat with them at their houses. After a while I went to sleep. Chapter 12 The room was long, with windows on the right-hand side, and a door at the far end that went into the dressing room. The row of beds that mine was in faced the windows, and another row, under the windows, faced the wall. If you lay on your left side, you could see the dressing room door. There was another door at the far end that people sometimes came in by. If anyone were going to die, they put a screen around the bed so you could not see them die, but only the shoes and putties of doctors and men nurses showed under the bottom of the screen, and sometimes at the end there would be whispering. Then the priest would come out from behind the screen, and afterward the men nurses would go back behind the screen to come out again, carrying the one who was dead with a blanket over him down the corridor between the beds, and someone folded the screen and took it away. That morning the major in charge of the ward asked me if I felt that I could travel the next day. I said I could. He said then they would ship me out early in the morning. He said I would be better off making the trip now before it got too hot. When they lifted you up out of the bed to carry you into the dressing room, you could look out of the window and see the new graves in the garden. A soldier sat outside the door that opened onto the garden, making crosses and painting on them the names, rank, and regiment of the men who were buried in the garden. He also ran errands for the ward, and in his spare time made me a cigarette lighter out of an empty Austrian rifle cartridge. The doctors were very nice and seemed very capable. They were anxious to ship me to Milan, where there were better X-ray facilities and where, after the operation, I could take mechanotherapy. I wanted to go to Milan, too. They wanted to get us all out and back as far as possible because all the beds were needed for the offensive when it should start. The night before I left the field hospital, Rinaldi came in to see me with a major from our mess. They said that I would go to an American hospital in Milan that had just been installed. Some American ambulance units were to be sent down, and this hospital would look after them and any other Americans on service in Italy. There were many in the Red Cross. The states had declared war on Germany, but not on Austria. The Italians were sure America would declare war on Austria, too, and they were very excited about any Americans coming down, even the Red Cross. They asked me if I thought President Wilson would declare war on Austria, and I said it was only a matter of days. I did not know what we had against Austria, but it seemed logical that they should declare war on her if they did on Germany. They asked me if we would declare war on Turkey. I said that was doubtful. Turkey, I said, was our national bird, but the joke translated so badly and they were so puzzled and suspicious that I said yes, we would probably declare war on Turkey. And on Bulgaria? We had drunk several glasses of brandy, and I said yes, by God, on Bulgaria too, and on Japan. But they said Japan is an ally of England. You can't trust the bloody English. The Japanese want Hawaii, I said. Where is Hawaii?
It is in the Pacific Ocean.
Why do the Japanese want it?
They don't really want it, I said. That is all talk. The Japanese are a wonderful little people, fond of dancing and light wines.
Like the French, said the Major.
We will get Nice and Savoia from the French.
We will get Corsica and all the Adriatic coastline, Rinaldi said.
Italy will return to the splendors of Rome, said the Major.
I don't like Rome, I said. It's hot and full of fleas.
You don't like Rome?
Yes, I love Rome. Rome is the mother of nations. I will never forget Romulus suckling the Tiber.
What?
Nothing. Let's all go to Rome. Let's go to Rome tonight and never come back.
Rome is a beautiful city, said the Major.
The mother and father of nations, I said.
Roma is feminine, said Rinaldi. It cannot be the father.
Who is the father, then? The Holy Ghost?
Don't blaspheme.
I wasn't blaspheming. I was asking for information.
You are drunk, baby.
Who made me drunk?
I made you drunk, said the Major.
I made you drunk because I love you and because America is in the war.
Up to the hilt, I said.
You go away in the morning, baby, Rinaldi said.
To Rome, I said.
No, to Milan.
To Milan, said the Major, to the Crystal Palace, to the Cova, to Campari's, to Biffi's, to the Galleria, you lucky boy.
To the Gran Italia, I said, where I will borrow money from George.
To the Scala, said Rinaldi.
You will go to the Scala.
Every night, I said.
You won't be able to afford it every night, said the Major.
The tickets are very expensive.
I will draw a sight draft on my grandfather, I said.
A what?
A sight draft. He has to pay or I go to jail.
Mr. Cunningham at the bank does it. I live by sight drafts.
Can a grandfather jail a patriotic grandson who is dying that Italy may live?
Live the American Garibaldi, said Rinaldi.
Viva the sight drafts, I said.
We must be quiet, said the Major.
Already we have been asked many times to be quiet.
Do you go tomorrow, really, Federico?
He goes to the American hospital, I tell you, Rinaldi said.
To the beautiful nurses, not the nurses with beards of the field hospital.
Yes, yes, said the Major. I know he goes to the American hospital.
I don't mind their beards, I said.
If any man wants to raise a beard, let him.
Why don't you raise a beard, Signor Maggiore?
It could not go in a gas mask.
Yes, it could. Anything can go in a gas mask. I vomited into a gas mask.
Don't be so loud, baby, Rinaldi said. We all know you have been at the front. Oh, you fine baby, what will I do when you are gone?
We must go, said the Major. This becomes sentimental.
Listen, I have a surprise for you. You're English, you know? The English you go to see every night at their hospital? She is going to Milan, too. She goes with another to be at the American hospital.
They had not got nurses yet from America. I talked today with the head of their reparto.
They have too many women here at the front. They send some back.
How do you like that, baby?
All right.
Yes?
You go to live in a big city and have your English there to cuddle you.
Why don't I get wounded?
Maybe you will, I said.
We must go, said the Major. We drink and make noise and disturb Federico.
Don't go.
Yes, we must go. Goodbye, good luck. Many things. Ciao, ciao, ciao.
Come back quickly, baby.
Rinaldi kissed me.
You smell of Lysol.
Goodbye, baby, goodbye. Many things.
The Major patted my shoulder. They tiptoed out. I found I was quite drunk, but went to sleep.
The next day in the morning we left for Milan and arrived 48 hours later. It was a bad trip. We were sidetracked for a long time this side of Mestre, and children came and peeked in. I got a little boy to go for a bottle of cognac, but he came back and said he could only get grappa. I told him to get it, and when it came I gave him the change, and the man beside me and I got drunk and slept until past Vicenza, where I woke up and was very sick on the floor. It did not matter, because the man on that side had been very sick on the floor several times before. Afterward I thought I could not stand the thirst, and in the yards outside of Verona I called to a soldier who was walking up and down beside the train, and he got me a drink of water. I woke Giorgetti, the other boy who was drunk, and offered him some water. He said to pour it on his shoulder and went back to sleep.
The soldier would not take the penny I offered him and brought me a pulpy orange. I sucked on that and spit out the pith and watched the soldier pass up and down past a freight car outside, and after a while the train gave a jerk and started.
Book 2 Chapter 13 We got into Milan early in the morning, and they unloaded us in the freight yard. An ambulance took me to the American hospital. Riding in the ambulance on a stretcher, I could not tell what part of town we were passing through, but when they unloaded the stretcher, I saw a marketplace and an open wine shop with a girl sweeping out. They were watering the street, and it smelled of the early morning. They put the stretcher down and went in. The porter came out with them. He had gray mustaches, wore a doorman's cap, and was in his shirt sleeves. The stretcher would not go into the elevator, and they discussed whether it was better to lift me off the stretcher and go up in the elevator, or carry the stretcher up the stairs. I listened to them discussing it. They decided on the elevator. They lifted me from the stretcher. "Go easy," I said. "Take it softly." In the elevator we were crowded, and as my legs bent, the pain was very bad. "Straighten out the legs," I said. "We can't, Signor Tenente. There isn't room." The man who said this had his arm around me, and my arm was around his neck. His breath came in my face, metallic with garlic and red wine. "Be gentle," the other man said. "Son of a bitch, who isn't gentle?" "Be gentle, I say," the man with my feet repeated. I saw the doors of the elevator closed, and the grill shut, and the fourth-floor button pushed by the porter. The porter looked worried. The elevator rose slowly. "Heavy?" I asked the man with the garlic. "Nothing," he said. His face was sweating, and he grunted. The elevator rose steadily and stopped. The man holding the feet opened the door and stepped out. We were on a balcony. There were several doors with brass knobs. The man carrying the feet pushed a button that rang a bell. We heard it inside the doors. No one came. Then the porter came up the stairs. "Where are they?" the stretcher-bearers asked. "I don't know," said the porter. "They sleep downstairs." "Get somebody." The porter rang the bell, then knocked on the door, then he opened the door and went in. When he came back, there was an elderly woman wearing glasses with him. Her hair was loose and half-falling, and she wore a nurse's dress. "I can't understand," she said. "I can't understand Italian." "I can speak English," I said. "They want to put me somewhere." "None of the rooms are ready. There isn't any patient expected." She tucked at her hair and looked at me nearsightedly. "Show them any room where they can put me." "I don't know," she said. "There's no patient expected. I couldn't put you in just any room." "Any room will do," I said. Then to the porter in Italian, "Find an empty room." "They are all empty," said the porter. "You are the first patient." He held his cap in his hand and looked at the elderly nurse. "For Christ's sweet sake, take me to some room." The pain had gone on and on with the legs bent, and I could feel it going in and out of the bone. The porter went in the door, followed by the gray-haired woman, then came hurrying back. "Follow me," he said. They carried me down a long hallway and into a room with drawn blinds. It smelled of new furniture. There was a bed and a big wardrobe with a mirror. They laid me down on the bed. "I can't put on sheets," the woman said. "The sheets are locked up." I did not speak to her. "There is money in my pocket," I said to the porter, "in the button-down pocket." The porter took out the money. The two stretcher-bearers stood beside the bed holding their caps. "Give them 5 lire apiece and 5 lire for yourself. My papers are in the other pocket. You may give them to the nurse." The stretcher-bearers saluted and said thank you. "Goodbye," I said, "and many thanks." They saluted again and went out. "Those papers," I said to the nurse, "describe my case and the treatment already given." The woman picked them up and looked at them through her glasses. There were 3 papers, and they were folded. "I don't know what to do," she said. "I can't read Italian. I can't do anything without the doctor's orders." She commenced to cry and put the papers in her apron pocket. "Are you an American?" she asked, crying. "Yes. Please put the papers on the table by the bed." It was dim and cool in the room. As I lay on the bed, I could see the big mirror on the other side of the room, but could not see what it reflected. The porter stood by the bed. He had a nice face and was very kind.
You can go, I said to him. You can go too, I said to the nurse. What is your name?
Mrs. Walker.
You can go, Mrs. Walker. I think I will go to sleep. I was alone in the room. It was cool and did not smell like a hospital. The mattress was firm and comfortable, and I lay without moving, hardly breathing, happy in feeling the pain lessen. After a while, I wanted a drink of water and found the bell on a cord by the bed and rang it, but nobody came. I went to sleep. When I woke, I looked around. There was sunlight coming in through the shutters. I saw the big armoire, the bare walls, and two chairs. My legs in the dirty bandages stuck straight out in the bed. I was careful not to move them. I was thirsty, and I reached for the bell and pushed the button. I heard the door open and looked, and it was a nurse. She looked young and pretty. "Good morning," I said. "Good morning," she said, and came over to the bed. "We haven't been able to get the doctor. He's gone to Lake Como. No one knew there was a patient coming. What's wrong with you, anyway?" "I'm wounded, in the legs and feet, and my head is hurt." "What's your name?"
"Henry, Frederick Henry."
"I'll wash you up, but we can't do anything to the dressings until the doctor comes."
"Is Miss Barclay here?"
"No, there's no one by that name here."
"Who was the woman who cried when I came in?"
The nurse laughed. "That's Mrs. Walker. She was on night duty and she'd been asleep. She wasn't expecting anyone." While we were talking, she was undressing me, and when I was undressed, except for the bandages, she washed me very gently and smoothly. The washing felt very good. There was a bandage on my head, but she washed all around the edge.
"Where were you wounded?"
"On the Isonze, north of Plava."
"Where's that?"
"North of Gorizia." I could see that none of the places meant anything to her.
"Do you have a lot of pain?"
"No, not much now."
She put a thermometer in my mouth.
"The Italians put it under the arm," I said.
"Don't talk."
When she took the thermometer out, she read it and then shook it. "What's the temperature?"
"You're not supposed to know that.
Tell me what it is."
"It's almost normal."
"I never have any fever. My legs are full of old iron, too."
"What do you mean?"
"They're full of trench mortar fragments, old screws and bed springs and things."
She shook her head and smiled.
"If you had any foreign bodies in your legs, they would set up an inflammation and you'd have fever."
"All right," I said, "we'll see what comes out."
She went out of the room and came back with the old nurse of the early morning. Together they made the bed with me in it. That was new to me and an admirable proceeding.
"Who's in charge here?"
"Miss Van Kampen."
"How many nurses are there?"
"Just us two."
"Won't there be more?"
"Some more are coming."
"When will they get here?"
"I don't know. You ask a great many questions for a sick boy."
"I'm not sick," I said. "I'm wounded."
They had finished making the bed, and I lay with a clean, smooth sheet under me and another sheet over me. Mrs. Walker went out and came back with a pajama jacket. They put that on me, and I felt very clean and dressed.
"You're awfully nice to me," I said. The nurse called Miss Gage giggled.
"Could I have a drink of water?" I asked.
"Certainly. Then you can have breakfast."
"I don't want breakfast. Can I have the shutters opened, please?" The light had been dim in the room, and when the shutters were opened it was bright sunlight, and I looked out on a balcony, and beyond were the tile roofs of houses and chimneys. I looked out over the tiled roofs and saw white clouds and the sky very blue.
"Don't you know when the other nurses are coming?"
"Why, don't we take good care of you?"
"You're very nice."
"Would you like to use the bedpan?"
"I might try."
They helped me and held me up, but it was not any use. Afterward, I lay and looked out the open doors onto the balcony.
"When does the doctor come?"
"When he gets back. We've tried to telephone to Lake Como for him."
"Aren't there any other doctors?"
"He's the doctor for the hospital."
Miss Gage brought a pitcher of water and a glass. I drank three glasses, and then they left me, and I looked out the window a while and went back to sleep. I ate some lunch, and in the afternoon Miss Van Kampen, the superintendent, came up to see me. She did not like me, and I did not like her. She was small and neatly suspicious and too good for her position. She asked many questions and seemed to think it was somewhat disgraceful that I was with the Italians. "Can I have wine with the meals?" I asked her. "Only if the doctor prescribes it."
"I can't have it until he comes?"
"Absolutely not."
"You plan on having him come eventually?"
"We've telephoned him at Lake Como."
She went out, and Miss Gage came back.
"Why were you rude to Miss Van Kampen?" she asked, after she had done something for me very skillfully.
"I didn't mean to be, but she was snooty."
"She said you were domineering and rude."
"I wasn't, but what's the idea of a hospital without a doctor?"
"He's coming. They've telephoned for him to Lake Como."
"What does he do there, swim?"
"No, he has a clinic there."
"Why don't they get another doctor?"
"Hush, hush. Be a good boy and he'll come."
I sent for the porter, and when he came, I told him in Italian to get me a bottle of Cinzano at the wine shop, a fiasco of Chianti, and the evening papers. He went away and brought them wrapped in newspaper, unwrapped them, and, when I asked him to, drew the corks and put the wine and vermouth under the bed. They left me alone, and I lay in bed and read the papers a while, the news from the front and the list of dead officers with their decorations, and then reached down and brought up the bottle of Cinzano and held it straight up on my stomach, the cool glass against my stomach, and took little drinks, making rings on my stomach from holding the bottle there between drinks, and watched it get dark outside over the roofs of the town. The swallows circled around, and I watched them and the nighthawks flying above the roofs and drank the Cinzano. Miss Gage brought up a glass with some eggnog in it. I lowered the vermouth bottle to the other side of the bed when she came in.
"Miss Van Kampen had some sherry put in this," she said.
"You shouldn't be rude to her. She's not young, and this hospital is a big responsibility for her. Mrs. Walker's too old, and she's no use to her."
"She's a splendid woman," I said. "Thank her very much."
"I'm going to bring your supper right away."
"That's all right," I said. "I'm not hungry."
When she brought the tray and put it on the bed table, I thanked her and ate a little of the supper. Afterward, it was dark outside, and I could see the beams of the searchlights moving in the sky. I watched for a while and then went to sleep. I slept heavily, except once I woke sweating and scared, and then went back to sleep, trying to stay outside of my dreams. I woke for good long before it was light and heard roosters crowing and stayed on awake until it began to be light. I was tired, and once it was really light, I went back to sleep again.
Chapter 14. It was bright sunlight in the room when I woke. I thought I was back at the front and stretched out in bed. My legs hurt me, and I looked down at them, still in the dirty bandages, and seeing them, knew where I was. I reached up for the bell cord and pushed the button. I heard it buzz down the hall, and then someone coming on rubber soles along the hall. It was Miss Gage, and she looked a little older in the bright sunlight and not so pretty.
"Good morning," she said. "Did you have a good night?"
"Yes, thanks very much," I said. "Can I have a barber?"
"I came in to see you, and you were asleep with this in the bed with you."
She opened the armoire door and held up the vermouth bottle. It was nearly empty.
"I put the other bottle from under the bed in there, too," she said. "Why didn't you ask me for a glass?"
"I thought maybe you wouldn't let me have it."
"I'd have had some with you."
"You're a fine girl."
"It isn't good for you to drink alone," she said. "You mustn't do it."
"All right."
"Your friend Miss Barclay's come," she said.
"Really?"
"Yes, I don't like her."
"You will like her. She's awfully nice."
She shook her head.
"I'm sure she's fine.
Can you move just a little to this side?"
"That's fine. I'll clean you up for breakfast."
She washed me with a cloth and soap and warm water.
"Hold your shoulder up," she said.
"That's fine."
"Can I have the barber before breakfast?"
"I'll send the porter for him."
She went out and came back.
"He's gone for him," she said, and dipped the cloth she held in the basin of water.
The barber came with the porter. He was a man of about 50 with an upturned mustache. Miss Gage was finished with me and went out, and the barber lathered my face and shaved. He was very solemn and refrained from talking.
"What's the matter? Don't you know any news?" I asked.
"What news?"
"Any news. What's happened in the town?"
"It is time of war," he said. "The enemy's ears are everywhere."
I looked up at him.
"Please hold your face still," he said, and went on shaving. "I will tell nothing."
"What's the matter with you?" I asked. "I am an Italian. I will not communicate with the enemy."
I let it go at that. If he was crazy, the sooner I could get out from under the razor, the better. Once I tried to get a good look at him.
"Beware," he said. "The razor is sharp."
I paid him when it was over and tipped him half a lira. He returned the coins.
"I will not. I am not at the front, but I am an Italian."
"Get the hell out of here."
"With your permission," he said, and wrapped his razors in newspaper.
He went out, leaving the 5 copper coins on the table beside the bed. I rang the bell. Miss Gage came in.
"Would you ask the porter to come, please?"
"All right." The porter came in. He was trying to keep from laughing.
"Is that barber crazy?"
"No, signorino. He made a mistake. He doesn't understand very well, and he thought I said you were an Austrian officer."
"Oh," I said.
"Ho, ho, ho," the porter laughed. "He was funny. One move from you, he said, and he would have..."
He drew his forefinger across his throat.
"Ho, ho, ho,"
he tried to keep from laughing.
"When I tell him you were not an Austrian, ho, ho, ho."
"Ho, ho, ho," I said bitterly. "How funny if he would have cut my throat, ho, ho, ho."
"No, signorino, no, no. He was so frightened of an Austrian, ho, ho, ho."
"Ha, ha, ha," I said, "get out of here." He went out, and I heard him laughing in the hall. I heard someone coming down the hallway. I looked toward the door. It was Catherine Barclay. She came in the room and over to the bed.
"Hello, darling," she said.
She looked fresh and young and very beautiful. I thought I had never seen anyone so beautiful.
"Hello,"
I said. When I saw her, I was in love with her. Everything turned over inside of me. She looked toward the door, saw there was no one. Then she sat on the side of the bed and leaned over and kissed me. I pulled her down and kissed her and felt her heart beating.
"You sweet," I said. "Weren't you wonderful to come here?"
"It wasn't very hard. It may be hard to stay."
"You've got to stay," I said. "Oh, you're wonderful."
I was crazy about her. I could not believe she was really here, and held her tight to me.
"You mustn't," she said. "You're not well enough."
"Yes, I am. Come on."
"No, you're not strong enough."
"Yes, I am. Yes, please."
"You do love me?"
"I really love you. I'm crazy about you. Come on, please."
"Feel our hearts beating."
"I don't care about our hearts. I want you. I'm just mad about you."
"You really love me?"
"Don't keep on saying that. Come on, please. Please, Catherine."
"All right, but only for a minute."
"All right," I said. "Shut the door."
"You can't. You shouldn't."
"Come on, don't talk. Please, come on." Catherine sat in a chair by the bed. The door was open into the hall. The wildness was gone, and I felt finer than I had ever felt. She asked, "Now do you believe I love you?"
"Oh, you're lovely," I said. "You've got to stay. They can't send you away. I'm crazy in love with you."
"We'll have to be awfully careful. That was just madness. We can't do that."
"We can at night."
"We'll have to be awfully careful. You'll have to be careful in front of other people."
"I will."
"You'll have to be. You're sweet. You do love me, don't you?"
"Don't say that again. You don't know what that does to me."
"I'll be careful, then. I don't want to do anything more to you. I have to go now, darling, really."
"Come back right away."
"I'll come when I can."
"Goodbye."
"Goodbye, sweet."
She went out. God knows I had not wanted to fall in love with her. I had not wanted to fall in love with anyone. But God knows I had, and I lay on the bed in the room of the hospital in Milan, and all sorts of things went through my head, but I felt wonderful, and finally Miss Gage came in.
"The doctor's coming," she said. "He telephoned from Lake Como."
"When does he get here?"
"He'll be here this afternoon."